How did you come to be interested in energy issues and also working around energy issues?
I came to be interested in energy issues sort of by accident, in that I had done a completely unrelated degree at university, I'd had a series of completely unrelated jobs, and then I needed a new job. And I was at that point about 29, and I went to work for a company called the Energy Saving Trust, which was a government agency to promote energy efficiency in homes. And I just, luck got me working for that organisation. Once I was in the door, I suddenly realised there was this whole industry, this whole sector that I knew very little about, but that was going through tremendous change. And that was really interesting to me. I previously worked in the telecom sector at the point where it went from being, there was BT, and that was it. And suddenly there were hundreds and hundreds of companies operating in telecoms and internet services. And energy felt like it was about to do the same thing. You go from six companies, big companies, to hundreds and hundreds of different competitors, different technologies, you know, massive change in the industry. And that really drew me in. And that was probably also the moment in time when I had my little environmental awakening. So I was not born a green. I became one, probably to atone for not being very green in my 20s. So that was the point at which I started to really look into environmental issues, sustainability, different ways of living, and different choices that we make.
I'm glad you you mentioned how much it's changed, how much energy has changed, the conversation about it, because one of the things we were, when we were sort of coming up with our questions, and we were talking about the fact that in the past, you couldn't take energy for granted, because you had to, you know, you had to go and get your water, you couldn't turn the tap and it would come out. And we sort of think that young people really do take it for granted.
Right, yeah.
And we're interested on your opinion on how this could be addressed.
I think it's an interesting thought that if you go back far enough in this country, yes, we were all foraging and chopping down our trees and, you know, using the wood for fuel, et cetera, et cetera. We've separated ourselves from that. We can't see how energy is produced. Or for recent years, we haven't been able to see how energy is produced. It's been something in a big power station somewhere far away. That's changing slightly now because more and more things like solar panels, solar farms, wind turbines are popping up, and they're very visible. And they're spread all over the country, so we're more aware that energy is being produced locally. I think a way of really engaging people with it is actually to say, well, look, we're an unusual society. You know, the Western world is slightly unusual. There's still huge swathes of the world where people still have to go and collect water from a well, have to go and collect wood from fallen trees to light a fire. And it's really interesting to then talk about the energy transition that those countries are going through compared to ours. And so say, well, actually, a lot of them are leapfrogging all the dirty energy that we were using and going straight to the renewable sources of power because they're leaner, they're quicker to install, where, you know, you don't have to build great big networks across vast tracts of desert or whatever it might be. You can just have a local hub of energy. So it's a curious thing that's happened, a curious dynamic, but that would be an interesting way of engaging people, I think.
Do you think it's likely that we'd ever return to that sort of state of having to go and collect our own firewood and going and getting our own water and that sort of thing?
I don't think so. I think we've got too used to it being to things being provided. And if anything, our culture now is much more about things being brought to us. So we used to go to the greengrocers and the butchers, you know, every day and collect what you needed for that day. That changed to going to the supermarket once a week to get your food for the week. Actually, that's now changed to the supermarket bringing your food to you. So to then say, well, actually, we want to go back to a culture, you know, would we go back to something where we have to go and make the effort to go and get stuff? I don't know. I don't think so yet. You do see it in more rural communities where, you know, people can go in, where there are fallen trees, you can go and collect firewood. Absolutely fine. I think in cities it will be almost impossible. Cities aren't, there just aren't enough resources in cities for us all to gather what we need. So I don't think we would.
So what do you think we could do to make sort of people more aware of the amount of energy they're using within their communities, in London especially?
I think we have to think about the different scales that people operate at. So I you know, live in a flat with one other person, we use a certain amount of energy. Actually, that whole block of flats, there's 18 flats in the block. So the block uses a certain amount of energy. We're in a street. The street is in a town suburb. The suburb is in a borough. You can start to build up these levels where people sort of engage with it. There have been some great experiments and tests in recent years of helping people to compare their energy use with their neighbours or with typical energy use, and doing it not through numbers and technology and science language, but through smiley faces. You know, you get a smiley face if you're better than average. You get a sad face if you're worse than average. If you get a sad face coming through on your energy bill, it prompts you to go, oh, how can I use less energy?
Yeah.
So there are some simplistic things that we can do to make people aware. That gets us into thinking about how we use energy at the end of it, you know, the end of the chain, if you like. It doesn't get people thinking about where energy comes from. And that's a real challenge on a day-to-day basis. You know, if you don't see solar PV panels, you don't see wind turbines. Or even if you do, actually that's only part of the equation. That's the electricity bit. And one thing that is, electricity has become more visible because of, you know, new technologies. The big bit of the equation of the energy we use at home is about heating and hot water. And that's usually gas. And that's just something that happens in a boiler in the corner when you push a button. And that's really hard to make visible to people. There is this sort of thing providing this energy service to you at home, this heat service to you at home, and where that comes from and how that's treated and how that's processed is a really difficult conversation, I think.
Okay. We're going to move on to the economy and energy.
Okay.
Yes. So, in your view, what is the relationship between energy and the economy?
There wouldn't be an economy without energy. We rely on energy to make everything that we eat, that we wear, the way we travel, the things we build. Every single product is just jammed full of energy. The difficulty we face is that some products take an awful lot more energy than others, and we tend to like some of those products. Beef, for example, we kind of like a nice steak, but growing a cow, if you like, rearing a cow, uses an awful lot more energy than growing a field of wheat, mainly because you have to grow a field of wheat to feed to the cow to grow the cow. So actually there are some energy just built into everything that we do. And even, you know, we talked about making the simple thing of how you heat your home visible. Once you start talking to people about, oh, well, this chair contained more energy than that chair, it starts to get really complicated, and it's almost too much information for people to think about and to deal with. Mm-hmm. But yeah, energy and economy go hand in hand.
Yeah, and touching on that, I was actually, in our bid to gain energy, to gain power for our own economy, how can we ensure equality and fairness with the countries that we trade with?
So in how we...
Yeah, so for example, politicians who... politicians that do trades in Nigeria,
so to speak.
Or in countries that are not as economically developed as we are. How can we ensure equality and fairness
within
trade, specifically around energy?
That's not an area in which I'm an expert, I will say. What I would draw, that there's a lot of discussion now in different types of procurement of products and services about social value and social sort of socially motivated contracts, where you're not just buying something for a price, but you're actually building something in there which is about benefiting the community that you're buying from, or the community that's local to what you're doing. I do think it gets geopolitically very messy, and you start to get into discussions about whether ethical standards that apply here apply in other countries, be that whether it's appropriate to take backhanders, whether here a bribe is illegal. In other parts of the world, a payoff is not an illegal bribe, it's just how you do business. So I think there are big ethical issues to grapple with there. I do think that if actually you can just have the words equality and fairness written in the brains of policymakers, so that that's part of the impact assessment they're doing on a new policy or a new trade agreement. So, well, okay, how is this going to affect the most vulnerable in society or the poorest in society? Mm-hmm. Then you might not get it right, but at least you've gone through the thought process.
Yeah. If we're talking about people with a lot of power,
mm-hmm.
How do you think sort of international companies like Starbucks mm-hmm. or Apple,
yeah.
Who have built their business and sustained their business mm-hmm. using energy,
mm-hmm.
obviously, but also in how they produce their cups, make the coffee,
yeah.
all those things, how do you see them surviving without these things?
I think the big corporations go through a bit of a curve as they grow and as they become big. I think they all start, they start out generally, I wouldn't say all, as kind of groovy companies. They don't start out as huge companies. They start out as little, quite groovy companies who are doing something new. They tend to be doing it in quite a nice, creative, different way. And that's why they get to be successful. And then when you become big and successful, the pressure is on and you've got other demands from shareholders, from investors, from customers to keep your prices down. So there's all this pressure on you to sort of maybe cut some corners that you didn't mean to. You weren't planning to cut those corners. You just ended up cutting them. I think actually now what we're seeing is those companies coming out the other side of that and saying, well, hang on a second. These ways of doing business, this sort of energy-hungry, non-recyclable plastic way of doing business is not sustainable in the long term. It might get us good short-term profits, but in 10 years' time, what damage will we have done economically to our customers, to our environment, to ourselves? So you'll see, I think, the bigger companies are starting to go, well, how can we do this differently? And sustainability makes a lot of business sense. And more now that you're seeing big companies reporting on their sustainability performance and linking it to their economic performance and saying, well, actually, we've been really profitable and really sustainable, it starts to set a model for future companies coming through. I think one of the interesting things now is the number of universities and business schools that are putting sustainability into business education and, you know, leadership courses, MBAs, that sort of thing, to really say, look, this is the new model of how we do business, because the old models are, you know, grubby.
Yeah. Touching on that, how do you think the government could play a role in, for example, what kind of policies would you like to see to reduce fuel poverty? Because if we think mm-hmm. about companies who are overly using, mm-hmm. who are using fuel and energy excessively,
mm-hmm.
What kind of policies do you think government could put into place to reduce fuel poverty in the UK?
So fuel poverty for individual householders.
In general, yeah, I suppose so, yeah.
Well, the idea of fuel poverty is that you... It's a combination, so it's partly to do with your income, and it's partly to do with the type of property you live in, and it's partly to do with the cost of energy. And fuel poverty tends to be worse. So fuel poverty means in reality is that you either use the energy you need to keep warm, but you can't afford it, so you fall into massive debt, or you decide not to use the energy you need, so you don't go into debt, but you then potentially have health issues, as well as, you know, well-being, anxiety issues, and so on and so forth. Historically, energy prices sort of in the 2000s came right down. It was fine, we could all afford enough energy, woo-hoo. And then energy prices went way back up again. And people who were vulnerable because they were on low incomes, vulnerable because they're living in big old leaky properties that they can't keep warm, they've got old heaters and old boilers that they can't use, they can't afford their energy, started to fall into real problems. The guaranteed way, not guaranteed anymore, but the almost guaranteed, the almost surefire way of fixing a fuel poverty problem is to improve the energy performance of the property. So it's to put in better insulation, to put in new heating systems, put in, you know, sort out leaky windows and drafty windows, things like that. And that's where policy is going, that's where a lot of the campaigning groups have gone and the lobbying has gone, is to say, look, really, that's the way. Because people's incomes will go up and down, as they move in and out of work, if they move in on and off different benefits or support mechanisms. And energy prices will go up and down according to things that we can't control.
Yeah.
If you can sort out the property, you minimise the risks associated with the other two.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So let's talk about oil.
Mm. Okay.
Oil, as we know, is running out, mm-hmm. especially at the speed which we're using it. And some people are of the opinion that we should use it until it runs out, mm-hmm. just keep going until it's gone. What do you think about that?
Everything has consequences. And, yeah, we could continue to use all the oil, we can continue to use all the gas, we could chop down trees and burn them and not replace them. We can dig up all the uranium and, you know, do crazy things with that in reactors. Each of those has a different set of consequences. And the consequences of using all the oil and using all the gas is a change in climate. And the danger is that the people who want to keep on using a lot of oil and gas are those who will not feel the strongest effects of climate change. It's actually the people who are sort of who aren't using the most oil and gas, the marginalised from that part of the economy thus far, are those most vulnerable. And again, then you get into the equality and fairness discussion about actually how much do we value a company's ability to make money and products versus the lives of a city in Bangladesh, which is going to be underwater in a couple of years' time. You know, discuss. And hopefully that's enough of a moral position that, you know... And we don't really talk about morality and ethics enough, I don't think, in energy policy. We talk about supply and demand and fixing and incentives, but actually really talking about ethics and morality.
So if you were in power, what would be your energy strategy?
My energy strategy. Do you know what? I asked some people to write about this for our SE2 blog, and most people I asked said, oh, it's too difficult. I would tell people what my strategy was. Haven't written it yet. But I would set it for a long time and I would tell people what it was. Now that sounds silly, but actually energy strategies and energy policies change every single year, and the people who are trying to transform the energy system go, oh, hang on, are we doing this? Oh, we're doing this year. And have to jump back and forth and do, you know, invest in one thing and then go, oh, no, we're not doing that anymore. So they have to go, oh, okay, and invest in something else. So I'd set it out and say, this is what it is. It would be a realistic shift from the resources that we're using now to the resources of the future. We are not going to get rid of, you know, gas provides heat and hot water to probably 20 million homes in this country. You can't just switch it off. So we need to have a plan for actually what's going to take the place of gas and how you bring that in and where you bring that in over a period of time. Electricity, yes, much easier. Renewables, lovely, lovely renewables. Solar PV, wind, heat pumps, all these wonderful, wonderful things. Not heat pumps. But the idea there is these things are generating energy, not always when we need them, when we need it. So invest lots and lots in energy storage technologies, research and development to get effectively batteries so that you can generate electricity from the sun during the day. You come home from work or from college in the evening, you decide, right, I'm going to switch on the lights and the telly and there's electricity for you and you've generated it. The sun has generated it for you.
Okay, so let's keep with the renewable energy thing and different types of energy, because this, what I'm going to ask you is not renewable, I don't think. Would, sort of in your strategy, do you think fracking is part of that? Is that in do you think that's part of our future, part of our energy future?
Well, fracking is about gas, and I'm trying to get us off gas, because gas is one of those dirty fuels. Fracking, all energy comes with consequences. The consequences of fracking are the long-term contribution to climate change, but also the short-term devastation of quite a lot of countryside. I think, I don't want to play down Oklahoma, but Oklahoma is very big, very flat, very empty. And so you can put lots of stuff in there and nobody really notices. Kent is quite small, quite busy, you know, there's quite a lot of people there. I am emotionally more attached to Kent than I am to Oklahoma. That's another matter entirely. I don't think we need it. I think it's a retrograde step on a path to getting rid of gas. So to say we're getting rid of gas in the long term, here's some new gas. That just seems silly in my energy strategy. There are also now over 3,000 earthquakes a year in Oklahoma. And 10 years ago, there were no earthquakes a year in Oklahoma. So discuss. Yes. We still want earthquakes. No fracking.
Do you feel that wind power could potentially be a solution for the future
of
energy?
Yeah, and it's already doing a job. I am a big fan of wind power. I actually think, and you always get into aesthetics when you talk. Don't talk about aesthetics of anything else, but wind turbines, we talk about how pretty they are or not. I like them. They do a decent job. The technology needs to improve. The efficiency of wind turbines needs to get better, but it will, because they're becoming more and more mainstream. The UK has done really, really well on offshore wind and onshore wind, and I think we'll continue to do that because we have a lot of it. You have to have a backup plan for what happens when the wind doesn't blow. That's the main thing. You also have to have an energy grid, a national grid, appropriately, where rather than electricity being transmitted from, you know, some big power stations, it's coming from thousands and thousands of smaller power stations in remote areas or offshore. So there's that kind of system change as well that needs to happen.
Do you feel that renewable energy could be cost-effective, and how cost-effective can sustainable energy be?
I think it is. Depending on the factors that the considerations that you put in about, you know, the costs of damage that you are doing by using fossil fuels versus damage you're not doing by using renewables. What also doesn't get talked about much, you know, renewable energy gets subsidies at the moment to try and help make it, you know, to balance it out and make it cost effective compared to oil and gas and nuclear. And oil and gas and nuclear get huge subsidies every year. So again, it's one of those things you go, well, hang on, what are we subsidizing and why? In my long-term energy strategy, which I'm going to tell everybody about because people need to have an idea of what's going to come, I think that there would be a kind of, again, you can't just switch off the subsidies. There's a bit of reality checking that goes in, which says, okay, we phase down subsidies for things we don't want to support, like the dirty industries, knowing that we still need those products until we transition to a cleaner economy. Subsidise the good, groovy stuff.
Well, okay, you mentioned nuclear energy.
Mm-hmm.
What do you see a future for nuclear energy in the UK?
If you'd asked me a few years ago, I would have said no. I'm one of those kind of uncomfortable people who have gone from really hating nuclear to thinking, well, it could have a part to play because it generates electricity without the variability. So the sun only shines in the day, the wind only blows at certain times. Nuclear can just sit there and just churn away and generate electricity for you. So it's actually very reliable for that. It has its consequences. So the price you pay for nuclear, risks of large-scale accidents, risks of leaks. It's, you know, the industry says it's getting safer, but I don't know. Actually, what do you do with it? What do you do with all the spent fuel? Where do we store radioactive waste? There's been an ongoing consultation for about the last 15 years about where we store radioactive waste in this country. And just when a solution was reached, some people who were involved in that went, nah, actually, we've changed our mind. So it's going round again. And so those sort of logistical management issues, can we keep radioactive material safe from whoever or wherever? Can we keep it in a safe environment so it doesn't leach into the ground or into water supplies? Can we keep it safe from marauding terrorists who are going to come and steal all our spent uranium and, I don't know, do something crazy with it? Those are the sorts of considerations around nuclear. My other worry with nuclear is that you become dependent on those countries which have sources of uranium, so uranium mining. Actually, those tend to be politically a bit more stable than the ones with oil. So, you know, okay, well, we manage that relationship for oil and for gas reasonably well. Australia, South Africa, Namibia, places like that tend to have lots of uranium, I think Canada as well, and we have reasonable relationships with them. And they're fairly stable, you know, nations. But if we go nuclear and other countries in the world say, yay, nuclear, we're all chasing after the same small amount of fuel. Mm, yeah. And economically that becomes a challenge.
Yeah. This is a bit of a different question. Mm-hmm. Well, not very different, but you kind of touched on buildings mm-hmm. and, you know, these sort of buildings being able to deal with fuel better in a sense of being more efficient.
Yeah.
What do you think should be done to encourage more renewable energy, new buildings, domestic and commercial?
I do think we can do more. For a while, we had a thing called Code for Sustainable Homes, which was putting in place standards and requirements for how much energy a new building could use, a new home could use. And then it was up to the builder to decide how to make that work, be it through lots of insulation or through renewables or through, you know, different approaches to energy generation and energy efficiency. That sort of vanished a bit, which is very, very sad. I do think we can mandate things in new buildings. France have just done it. I think you can't build now in France without putting solar panels on the roof or having a very good reason why not. So I do think for new buildings we can mandate that sort of thing. The challenge we have actually is our existing buildings. We've already got those 25 million homes. Most of them will still be around in 50 years. With drafty windows and drafty floors and leaky roofs and thin walls leaching energy out. Just as, you know, make a room nice and warm and all the energy will just dissipate from the building. So a big challenge is how we deal with those homes. Particularly, you know, new homes are easier because new homes are being built by a builder. So you go to the builder and say, do this. And you influence 100 homes or 1,000 or however many they're building. Our existing homes are split up amongst all of us. So suddenly you have to influence 25 million households to do something. And that becomes incredibly challenging, incredibly difficult.
So talking about the future,
mm-hmm.
What do you think is the future of energy in London?
Future of energy in London. There are some really exciting things going on in London. I think you'll see a lot more locally generated energy and locally managed energy. Islington Council already do an awful lot in terms of local generation of heat and electricity. There are different heat and electricity sort of generating schemes around London, and there's long been talk about joining them all up into a big network so that London, like you have the M25 effectively, or the North Circular Road, you'd effectively have the London energy network or London heat network all around the capital, which would be amazing and very efficient and good and clean. We'll see more. I think we should see more use of roof space for solar panels. I think we should make more of the Thames estuary and sort of industrial bits of Essex and Kent for wind. Blowy out there. We can make more of the Thames as a source of heat as well. And there's a scheme down in Kingston which is generating using a heat pump to get the latent heat from the river and use that to provide heat into a block of flats, which is quite exciting. So we need to, it's what we were talking about earlier a little bit, of going back to using the resources that are available to us.
How far do you think we are away from being London, being entirely powered by renewable energy, sustainable?
From renewable energy, a very long way. From a more sustainable energy system. still a long way. I mean, it's a very big challenge. It's a big city. I think, actually, by making visible some of the energy infrastructure that's already there and showcasing, you know, some of the schemes that do exist, it gives inspiration to others. So there's Repowering Brixton have been putting solar panels on tower blocks and schools and so on and so forth. If you can take that sort of model and take it to other parts of London, it starts to really open up. It's very tricky in London. We have a lot of flats. We have a lot of very old buildings. We have a lot of rented buildings. We have commercial space, which just eats electricity for breakfast. So I think we've got models of what it could look like. What we don't have yet is the scale. So if I was the Mayor of London, it'd be a fabulous job. That's what I would be looking at, is how you take the models that seem to be working in different communities and you scale them up across the city.
Okay, this is sort of a rounding up question.
Okay.
What sort of legacy would you like to leave future generations around energy?
That's a great question. Terrifying.
It could be.
Well, I would like to think that because of the work that I've done and that my company's done, we have very directly helped some individual people to be able to live more comfortably and manage their energy more effectively, and then to scale that up to say that there are some communities that are better off in terms of more self-sufficient, more sustainable. I guess a lot of our work is actually about capacity building and confidence and helping people to talk about the issues and then make strategies and make plans for how to deal with them. So I'm probably never going to leave, you know, 300 wind turbines with my name on them. Mm. But if I can have spoken to communities who have then thought, yeah, actually, we now understand, we've got the confidence to go and build those 300 wind turbines, maybe it's that little bit there.
So would you say, it's our last question, are you an optimist or a pessimist when you're thinking about the future?
Oh, dear, I'm in the middle. Do you know, I was at a workshop not so long ago and drew a line along the wall and said, all the optimists who think we can solve all our problems and save the day, go and stand over there. And all the pessimists who think, oh, we're all doomed, go and stand over there. I think we can solve an awful lot of our problems through technology, through innovation, through creativity, through just sheer belligerence, and through talking about them and coming up with good ideas. I think that there's a certain climate change path that we're on that we can't get off right now. Mm. And so there's a certain amount of pessimism from me about the consequences of that for, not necessarily in this country, but for other communities around the world. I also talked a lot about the big corporates and how some of them are starting to transition to this new way of thinking, new way of working. There's an awful lot that aren't. And there's those other companies that are now coming up that curve who maybe are still invested in the old ways of doing business. So I think there's still an awful lot to do. Yeah. Cool. So I can be both an optimist and a pessimist.
In the room, where did most people go?
There were people all the way along. And, there were some proper optimists and some proper pessimists, and then a big bunch of us in the middle going, well, I'm a little bit that and a little bit that. So indecisive people.
Cool. Thank you. No